Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If it's just us in this universe, what a terrible waste of space. But it's not. Before the end of this century, and perhaps much sooner than that, scientists will determine that life exists elsewhere in the universe. This conversation this hour is about, and the book that we base our conversation on, is about how they're going to get there. And when they do, that discovery will rival the immensity of those that launched our previous scientific revolutions, and in the process defined our humanity. For thousands of years, humans have wondered about who and what might be living beyond the confines of our planet. Gods, beneficent or angry, a heaven full of sinners long forgiven, creatures as large and strange as our imagination, scientists are now on the cusp of bringing those musings back to Earth and recasting our humanity yet again. That's in the beginning of First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Mark Kaufman is our guest this hour. He's a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post. He has spent more than 30 years covering all of these issues of science and space. But the field that he writes about, astrobiology, is a young but fast-growing field. And he traveled all over the world and into the world, actually, into the Earth, to write this book. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine we'll have many. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Oh, you just went all over the place to do this, including into caves, didn't you?
Well, not so much the caves, but the mines, the deep mines of South Africa.
Yeah.
Deepest mines in on Earth. They go down, some of them, 2.5-3 miles. In that case, I was looking for, I was spending time with researchers who were looking for microbial life way below the surface of the Earth, where all previous scientific analysis had suggested they shouldn't exist. But of course they did, because they're everywhere.
Right. So people, why is it that people are looking way into deep mines and also into glaciers to find life? How does that relate to looking for life that's not on this planet? What do you learn about life elsewhere by finding that there's life like that here?
Well, the logic is, roughly speaking, one, that life is unbelievably tenacious and so could exist on a lot of different places where we didn't imagine. But two, specifically about Mars, there is the current consensus opinion is that Mars, about 4 billion years ago or so, was wet and warm. This was during a time when Earth was not. And so the question is, okay, Mars was the kind of place where life could begin at one point, and then a lot of those factors disappeared. The atmosphere was broken down, and the magnetic field disappeared, and it became very hot, and it became, very cold, and all kinds of terrible ultraviolet rays started hitting the surface and so on. So the question is, well, did the things that were alive, could they have migrated down into the subsurface and the deep subsurface of Mars? And we didn't really have a kind of proof of principle before that such a thing could happen, where you could have life that was living very deep and had really no connection whatsoever with the surface. But now we do, and we also have there's these very, very suggestive emissions of methane, which is a gas that is on Earth. 90% of it comes from organic sources. And in other words, life, and it is now known that it also spurts out of Mars at particular times and particular places. So that's the logic that potentially now we know that there are organisms that could live that deep, and we're wondering if maybe they're living there in Mars.
Right? You write that this whole field started blossoming when NASA found likely signatures of life in an ancient Martian meteorite that landed in Antarctica, but it was a somewhat controversial subject, the proof supporting the conclusion contested by many scientists, but nonetheless, it really sparked this whole profound interest in this very rapidly growing field.
Absolutely, yeah. This was the famous ALH84001 meteorite that fell in Antarctica, and NASA scientists analyzed it in deep secret for a period of time, and then there was a big presentation by NASA and also by the journal Science, which is the best really in the country, and ultimately there was an announcement by former then President Clinton. And it's a fascinating thing. I mean, in the world of astrobiology, an awful lot of the discoveries or claims that are made are really very quickly and aggressively jumped on and challenged, which in large part is as it should be. I mean, that's the way that science moves. And Carl Sagan famously said something to the effect that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And so... And these are in the field of extraordinary claims. The irony here with the Mars meteorite is that it was the science was really kind of viciously attacked and challenged, and then gradually was dismissed. And yet, 10, 15 years later, the same researchers are saying that they're proof now that there was signs of life in this meteorite is much greater than it was 15 years ago, but no one listened to him.
Oh, my. Tell me about the group of people who were doing all of this study of exoplanets and studying of these little microbes in mines and in glaciers and people who are looking through telescopes at exoplanets. Are they a new breed of scientists? You say they have achieved quite a bit of legitimacy lately. Who are they? Where do they come from? What's moving them?
Well, this is one of the things that's kind of fascinating about the field of astrobiology, was to me, that it is a really broad range of scientists who go from microbiologists, you know, through geologists and chemists and plane biologists and planetary scientists and cosmologists, and it's the most interdisciplinary field of all time, and yet there is a concentration, a real focus on the question of life beyond Earth, and to some extent how life began on Earth, and so they're working not so much in concert, but alongside each other. And then every second year, there's a big astrobiology conference in the U.S. I've been to two of them. And, you know, you have 10,000 people there.
Oh, my gosh.
So they're not necessarily all connected in terms of what they're researching. In fact, it's very different. But it's all kind of with a similar goal. I liken it to a stealth Apollo program, an enormous effort that's going on around the world, and yet no one really knows about it, or very few.
More will know about it now, thanks.
I hope so.
Thanks to you, Mark. Yeah. You talk about the mine in South Africa, but the search for extremophiles sending researchers to scores of equally harsh environments around the world. Where else are scientists going, and what have they discovered?
Well, it kind of began in two places. One was at Yellowstone, where you have the geyser, and there's enormous heat generated with the expelling of all that hydrothermic water. They found early on that there was microbial life living in some aspects of this really extreme environment. Then they found black smokers, which are similar kind of, but more intense, almost volcanoes underground, not underground, but rather under the ocean, where water is coming out and other things at almost 750 degrees. And yet they still found microbial life, not right in the middle of it, but along the sides of it. So that kind of started the idea and the science of extremophiles, if you will. And now it's moved to things like in glaciers. They find that down in Antarctica, you could go down 2 miles, and you're going to find microbial life in the ice. In Mono Lake out here in California, there is the highest concentration of arsenic known on Earth, naturally speaking, and it is filled with microbial life also. And it kind of goes on and on. You could be someplace that's very alkaline. You could be someplace that's extremely salty. You could find someplace where there's a very heavy radiation, and there can be microbial life. In fact, there are microbes in the atmosphere that are floating up there and surviving, existing, and reproducing. So that was kind of the revolution that that occurred, where they the realization that single cell life could exist in almost any place where it was given the slightest bit of chance. And here's kind of the clincher to it, that we now know that there was life on Earth for roughly 3.8 billion years. And of that time, about 3 billion of it was nothing but single-cell microbes. So if you find microbes somewhere, anywhere, you have to, I believe, assume that it has the capability to evolve into something else, into you and me and, you know, red meat, trees and everything.
Something extraordinary. Yeah. I remember the day of that. Because NASA really touted this. Was it NASA who did this, or was it somebody else, that arsenic discovery? It's going to be a major announcement. And I got so excited, because all my life I've been thinking, pretty soon they're going to introduce Archie or Anna or whoever it is from some other place, and it's going to be something quite extraordinary, and they're going to be really smart and very peaceful, and they're going to help us out and change our planet just for the good. I know there are a lot of people who think that the opposite could happen. So when it was discovery of life and arsenic, I think, oh, this is great, but darn it, where's the big...
Yes. And that's one of the interesting things, where the difference between kind of what the public is interested in, right, and looking for, and to some extent what scientists are. But the logic of the Mono Lake discovery was that what they put forward was that in Mono Lake, because of this very high concentration of arsenic, they were then able to take out some samples and work with them and bring them to the point where they had that the phosphorus that was in their DNA and in their cell lining all was replaced by arsenic, which on the table of elements is one is right next to each other, to the other. And that, if there was such a creature, and it's very hotly contested that the research is on target, but we could get back to that later. But if there was a form of life that had DNA that in it, instead of having phosphorus, which was believed to be in everything that was alive, instead had arsenic, it would open up a whole new field that would say, well, gee, maybe instead of one basic common ancestor for life on Earth, maybe there are quite a few others. We've just never looked for them.
So it's changed our whole idea of where we can find life. Has it changed and made more complete our definition of what life is?
This was one of the things that, as a non-scientist myself who reports on science, I had not fully understood, which is that there is no generally accepted definition of what life is. There was a book written recently, I think, the author found 390 definitions, definitions of life, all of them have some aspects of life, but all of them also leave some things out or describe just parts of what might be living. And as a result, you're kind of left with, and one of the people at NASA told me this with kind of a sheepish smile, was, you know, that life is, the definition is somewhat like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography, you know?
Oh, my.
We know when we see it,
right,
but we can't define it.
Huh. There is some, I was wondering about this because I wonder when it was going to take place. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about looking for life in glaciers and this Russian mission that's taking place sometime in 2011. I don't know if it's happened already, at Lake Vostok, where it will be a piercing of a pristine lake this year.
Again, very controversial. Until the mid-90s, science and all of us were unaware that there was this huge lake about 2 miles below the surface of Antarctica. It's the size of Lake Ontario.
Goodness.
Yeah, and no one knew it was there. And the I think the general sense that people would have of what a glacier and an environment like Antarctica is that you have a lot of ice, and then at the bottom of the ice you would have surface rocks, and that would be it. But in fact, there's a huge just collection of lakes underneath there and streams, because the further down you get, actually the warmer it gets, and so beneath the glacier, there are these lakes, and one of them is Lake Vostok. And the Russians have been sending down or working to reach Lake Vostok for probably 15, 20 years. Very complicated, and some of their machinery didn't quite work. And there's a lot of concern that they were using kerosene as part of the process, and that could quickly get into Lake Vostok if they did in fact breach it. I think now they are doing a much better job, or so the scientific world believes. But there still is this concern that whenever anything that is made by humans touches the water of Lake Vostok, it will immediately take the microbial life from whatever tool is going down, and you know, we'll never quite know whether or not that was there to begin with, or that was something unique. But what they are finding, and this has been scientifically established, that as they go down deeper and deeper, they are finding microbes that are unique all the way down. So there's every reason to think that there is a microbial world in Lake Vostok. And the fascinating big thing about that is, while we were talking before about Mars as being in another place where there could well be life, the other major candidate is the moon Europa outside of that orbits Jupiter, and it has a crust of several miles of ice, and then underneath it is a huge ocean. Most of the planet is an ocean, and given the kind of again, proof of principle we have with Lake Vostok and similar lakes, there's no reason to think that there isn't life underneath the crust of Europa.
Isn't that something?
It's a wild world out there.
Yeah, it's a wild world. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. And this book took him literally all over the world, to Japan and Russia and into a deep mine in South Africa. He's not a scientist, but he's probably could officially be called a scientist by now, just by the amount of research that he's done on all of these areas for the past 30 years. He's a science writer and national editor for the Washington Post. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We have to move about into so many different areas. We'll move into this whole SETI program and why we haven't heard or seen anything. This program's been around for some years now. Maybe some have suggested we should do more than listening. We need to be sending pings or flares that might get, I don't know if you can call them people or beings, attention in other places. So we'll talk about that. And welcome your calls. The email address, did I give you that? talk@wpr.org, 800-486-8655 for you to join our on-air conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls, and let's start with Connie in Madison. Hi, Connie.
Hi. The other evening, I had the pleasure of sitting at a banquet next to an organic chemist at the university, and he was speaking to me about the fact that there are organic molecules. This just blew my mind, organic molecules in interstellar space, and that it could take enormous millions of years before these atoms even bump into each other. I was wondering what you know about organic molecules in interstellar space, not planet-bound, and what percentage of these bumping intos would result in actually the formation of organic molecules with carbon, obviously, because it's organic, with carbon at their heart. Could you comment?
Sure. And thank you for the question. Your friend was absolutely right. And it goes, to my mind, far beyond what I ever imagined. It turns out that the organic molecules that you describe, as well as water, as well as oxygen, as well as hydrogen and nitrogen, all the elements, all the building blocks for life, are present almost throughout the universe. Some of the orbiting observatories have found clouds of something called polyaromatic hydrocarbons outside or surrounding nebula. These are fairly complex organic molecules. And so, yes, all the material for creating life is out there in space. My understanding is that there is virtually no chance that out in space that they could bond and form together in some way that could result in something, anything lifelike. But this is where the whole world of exoplanets comes in. This is where astrobiology is really taking off. They have found hundreds, now thousands, of exoplanets, and the expectation is that there will be billions, if not hundreds of billions, of planets found, and that a fair number of them will be in what are called habitable zones, which is the distance between them and the stars that they orbit is sufficient to, or is something that would allow for there to be liquid water, and where they wouldn't be parched and they wouldn't be frozen all the time. So the logic then is that if you have so many planets that are out there, it almost defies logic to think that there wouldn't be some that would be when organic hydrocarbons fall down on them, or other elements fall down, that this process is somewhat similar to what happened on Earth, wouldn't happen there as well. Meteorites hit other planets just as they hit our planet, bringing these elements and these complex molecules. So it's all part of this evolving picture where we now know that the universe is filled with all these ingredients. We now know that there are planets there to receive them, and that some of them are in zones that might be habitable. And we know that life is phenomenally tenacious and can exist in conditions that we never imagined before. So put it all together, and you have a pretty strong theoretical story that they're all working really, really hard to make into reality.
Hmm. Fascinating. Thank you, Connie, very much for your call. Our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We've done several shows on this search for exoplanets, and a lot of this is just being done by citizen scientists and people. You don't need to have a really fancy, expensive, huge telescope in some exotic location in the world. Some of this can be done in your backyard, right?
Some of it in terms of the radial velocity method, you could do that. You're absolutely right. There, for the For the really deep views, what we need is the kind of mission that is that's going on right now, the Kepler mission, which is a major NASA endeavor, and they have an orbiting observatory, and they're looking at one little chunk of the sky. It's 1/400th of the sky, and it's looking all the time at the planets that are there. I'm sorry, the stars that are there. They're like 100 or 150,000 stars, and they're looking for what are called transits, which is when a planet goes in front of the star. They don't actually see that, but what they see is a reduction in the radiation coming from the star, and that way they have identified more than 1,200 candidates in a short time, and it's through Kepler, where we believe that they will come up with these numbers that say, all right, if there are, 100,000 exoplanets in this one little area, then we could extrapolate and say, if you have 400 of those same little areas, there's no reason to think that you shouldn't multiply your number by 400.
And Kepler is going to give us, you write, substantial results this year.
Yes, and they already have given some results that are remarkable. They've found quite a few solar systems with more than one planet. They found one with six planets. They're finding some that they are convinced are rocky planets. In the past, it's been mostly the last large gas giants like Jupiter that are being found because they're the easiest to find. But they're finding rocky planets and planets that they believe are in that habitable zone. So this is just utterly revolutionizing, and they're just at the beginning of telling us what they're finding, because it's a fairly lengthy process between the actual observing and then analyzing all those ones and twos and making it into a logical picture that says, hey, we got a planet there, and it seems to be orbiting at this particular rate, and it seems to be roughly this size.
Hmm. Ron in Duluth, hi.
Hi, I'm just wondering how much this really matters, because any of these planets would be very far away, and there's no way to reach them even with an unmanned device because of the limitations of the speed of light.
You raise a reasonable question. In terms of whether it matters, let me backtrack for a sec. The logic again of astrobiology says that if there is any form of life that is found on Mars or Europa or any other body in our solar system, then you're confronted with a kind of a stark reality, which is that in one very in no way particularly unusual solar system, that you would have the genesis of two of life twice. And the likelihood of that happening, the probability, is so low, unless life is common elsewhere, that it's not something that could be accepted as scientifically acceptable. And so, if you do find life on Mars, life once existed on Mars, then we know that that life is a commonplace out there. And the question of how you then deal with it, how you contact it, how you, whether or not it matters, takes on a whole new meaning. We talk about the world of SETI, which is science, but less rigorous, not less rigorous, but less science with a lot less in terms of results at this point. But yes, it's a very complicated issue. How do you get out to look? Some of the top exoplanet folks now believe that with the rise of the commercial rocket industry, they're going to be able to get up into space much more cheaply, and that they're going to be able to design spacecraft that would get us to some of the closer stars, like Alpha Centauri, which is 4.3 light years away, still a very long way. But they believe that sometime in, you know, our lifetimes, perhaps, or in a couple generations, that they will be able to have missions to some of those exoplanets. But in kind of a fuller answer to your question, if we have that probability, you know, that close to 100% probability that life is common throughout the universe, even if we don't go out, if we can't go out and reach it and touch it and communicate with it and somehow, it's kind of like one of those moments like in the time of Copernicus, where everything gets turned on its head. You know, the universe doesn't, or the solar system, the sun, everything doesn't circle around the Earth, but the other way around. And forever we have kind of wished, hoped that there was life beyond Earth, but we've not known it. And suddenly we might be one of, you know, 6 billion places where there's life, as opposed to one of one.
Yeah. I keep thinking in the back of my head about those, that long, long period of time where we had these single-cell microbes, but that was about it. 3 billion years is a long time for those single-cell microbes to just hang around together. What happened then? Do we know? Do we need to know if there had to be something definite? Was it just an accident that life evolved into something more complicated than that? Are there a set of steps that need to take place for it to develop? How did it happen, and why did it take so long?
Well, one of the things that happened, and this was perhaps a little bit further along, but what happened was that the single-cell bacteria, particularly something called cyanobacteria, created oxygen. Oxygen is actually toxic to virtually everything that's alive, and creatures, organisms have to adapt in really profound ways in order to use oxygen. However, once you make that adaptation, then it appears that the ability to evolve into a more complex form increases. So you had these oceans of microbes, and you had a lot of these cyanobacteria that were taking in sunlight and sending out oxygen. And that process of making an atmosphere of oxygen appears to have played some significant role in some level of that going from very simple to more complex. And that's actually one of the things that that exoplanet specialists look to when going back to the earlier question: how will we know that there's life somewhere? If we could find, and they're getting much better at being able to do this, that an exoplanet is surrounded by an atmosphere of oxygen or an atmosphere of ozone, then we would know that the chances of there being life there are extremely high, probably in like the 97-98% probability range, simply because oxygen on its own, if there's a small amount to it, it will bond with other elements and then you won't be able to find it. But if there's a constant production of the oxygen, then boom, you know that there's probably something biological up there making it.
Bill in Prairie du Sac. Hi.
Hi. Just one question, because I don't understand this whole thing, is how do you define what life is? Is it by definition dealing with oxygen and carbon, or could it be any combination of two things that join together somehow?
This is something we talked about just a little bit before, but there is no working definition. Some of it has to do with, I think the NASA definition, which is not formal, but it's something to the effect that it's a chemical system that can metabolize, that is, take in material and then use it as energy and then spin it out, and that could also evolve in a Darwinian fashion. So those are the aspects of it, that it can replicate, that it can metabolize, and that it's a chemical system. But there are there was a book written recently saying that there were 390 or so plus definitions of life. One of the great ironies here is that in some way we won't know what life on Earth is until we find it somewhere else.
It's pretty heavy stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, it is pretty heavy stuff. Thanks, Bill. Let's go back to SETI for a moment because I know you went to Japan and looked through some pretty amazing telescopes. Has there been a lot of advancement? This was Carl Sagan's big thing as well in terms of how sophisticated the equipment is to send out messages. Is there still a controversy about whether or not we ought to be, instead of just listening, we ought to be sending something more into space?
Yes, to all the above. There has. When I got into this field and into this book, again, I'm a science writer, but I'm not a scientist. So I went into this with a lot of the understandings, I think, of, you know, regular people, the folks who are calling in and whatever, and I was very skeptical of SETI. It seemed kind of, you know, a little bit wacky and kind of a needle in a haystack kind of thing. But the more I learned about it, the more it became clear that it was kind of an essential bridge because of that vast difference between in space between us and other star systems where there might be planets. So I went up to the SETI Observatory that's being built in Hat Creek, California, up by Mount Shasta, and they now have 42 radio telescope dishes. If they had the money, they'd go up to 500, and this is allowing them to observe or listen for the radio signals in ways that they never could before. The array was largely funded by Paul Allen of Microsoft, so it's not like this is wacky stuff at this point. And it was, they have a collaboration with the University of California, Berkeley Radio Telescope Lab as well. So this is all pretty sophisticated stuff now, or it's very sophisticated stuff, but they do remain in a listening mode. But it's fascinating to hear some of the debate that's going on as to whether or not we should just be listening, or in the case of optical SETI, just watching to see if there are laser-like lights being sent in our direction, that might be messages. But there's also this notion of METI, which is the messaging of extraterrestrial intelligence. And it's very controversial. Stephen Hawking famously said a little while ago, don't do it because, if there are advanced civilizations out there, they will then know we're here and they'll come and they'll probably kill us. that the history of technologically advanced societies in relation to less advanced societies generally doesn't work out real well for the less advanced, and in this case that would be us. But on the other hand, given the vastness of the universe and given the vastness of the time that we're talking about, you know, this 14 billion years of since the Big Bang, roughly, unless we message, it may be impossible to reach any of the places where there might actually be living things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the debate that's going on. Do we send out messages so that we could potentially make that kind of communication and make it more likely, or are there really malevolent forces out there that we just don't, you know, we don't want them to know about us?
Right. And what do you think? We had an email from somebody who wondered about your opinion on Stephen Hawking's warning about those forces out there maybe being evil.
My own view, I mean, I have a relatively sunny view of the world.
Good for you. I'm glad.
And so it seems to me that the likelihood that these are going to be evildoers who are going to want to come in, I don't know, you know, take our resources and do us in, seem to be extremely small. However, the potential for, just kind of expanding our knowledge of the universe, and our knowledge of our place in the universe is so great that, I would kind of hate to see the opportunity go by.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating new book, First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth, Mark Kaufman. Mark is a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post, and this book took him all over the world looking at very interesting scientific research that's being done, discovering life in forms that we never knew existed here on this Earth, and discovering exoplanets and looking at what we've discovered on this Earth may relate to the possibility of life elsewhere. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Eric in Appleton. Hi, Eric.
Hi, great show. To me, the one thing we know about life on Earth is it's everywhere, literally. So I'll be shocked if there's life on Mars. I'd love to have life on Mars, but to me, if there's life on Mars and it's at least as old as life on Earth, it should be everywhere if it's there at all. So that's my comment. Thanks.
Thanks, Eric.
There is a logic to what you say. What happened on Mars was, again, this is the consensus view of planetary scientists at NASA and elsewhere, is that in that period of, I think, 4.2 to 3.7 billion years ago, it was a place that was pretty wet and warm. In other words, it was somewhat like the Earth is now. It had an atmosphere. It had a magnetic field that held the atmosphere into place, and that allowed for the surface to be protected in a way that it subsequently wasn't after the atmosphere disappeared and so did the magnetic field. But we do know increasingly, we know that there is a lot of water on Mars. It is now subsurface. The NASA's Phoenix mission found water ice just below the surface, and through other measurements they've found that under large chunks of Mars, there are big reservoirs of what appears to be frozen H2O. And since we now know that, one, microbes can live in frozen H2O, and two, we know that H2O used to be on the surface, because we could find, we see these gullies and deltas and so on. So there is this whole story, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but a tale, a narrative of there having been life there, and then either it was killed out or something happened, terrible happened, and then it gradually submerged itself under the surface and is now being protected. There's also a theory, and this is one of my favorite, it's called panspermia, that during this time that there was life on Mars, it's always being hit by meteorites, asteroids, and it kicks up chunks that then go out into space and circle around, and there might be microbial life in it that's kind of hibernating. The Earth from 4.5 billion years ago to a little bit under 4 billion years ago, very inhospitable place to live. The moon was formed when a big planet hit Earth, so I mean, like, it's just a big mess. Yet life begins here roughly 3.8 billion years ago. We don't know exactly, we'll never know how that happened, but some people think that maybe it was a microbe from Mars, and it's not just a maybe. I mean, it's a scientific maybe, that this is something that is plausible, which, of course, makes all of us Martians.
Well, that's a big thing to say.
But if I might, I mean, one of the things that I really sought very hard to do in the book, and it was consistent with kind of my approach to this, is because I'm not a scientist, I didn't want to write like a scientist. I wanted to write for a public that is interested in
people
science.
People like us. Mm-hmm.
A a well-educated public, but a public that can that will hopefully take in some of these really complicated ideas, but that I try to boil down, keeping them rigorous and honorable, but at the same time showing that this is stuff that all of us can, in fact, interact with. It's, you know, utterly, to me, it was eye-opening in so many ways in terms of the reality of the world that we live in. And then, you know, coupling that with the adventure of these astrobiologists trying to find it. So I try to harness both that ability to talk right to, you know, to people generally rather than to scientists, and to capture the excitement of the chase.
Yeah, and you do it well. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yes, I have a question, a comment and a question. First, I think it's very important that SETI succeed eventually and that we find that there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, because so many people I know, especially people of the more religious bent, they have this view of human exceptionalism, that we are somehow a unique creation of God, and that somehow God is watching over us, and that you know, we are special in some way. I think that if we found out for sure that there are intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe, whether we ever contact them or not, I think that might give us some motivation, because we would then know for sure that we are not special, that we could go extinct and the universe would not care one iota. And I guess my other question is, why is DNA in a right-hand thread? Why can't it form the other way? That's a molecular biology question, I guess. I just wonder if there's a law of physics bias that would make it DNA helixes go together the way they do, as opposed to the opposite direction.
All right, thank you.
Okay, I'll answer the second question first. This is the whole world of chirality, and it's a pretty complicated dynamic. But what the caller said is absolutely true, that there is this left-handedness to proteins, and there's a right-handedness to carbohydrates, and this is something that is essential to the formation of life. As far as we know, that is not something intrinsic to in the universe. Almost everything in the universe is equally right and left-handed, and I won't get into what that exactly means, because it's pretty complicated and hard to describe. But it is something that occurs that can be changed by star radiation and other things like that, and they have found that meteorites falling to Earth sometimes have just a slight excess of amino acids that have the left-handedness to them, and then that gets concentrated, and you end up with a world where everything that's biological is left-handed, whereas everything else in the world and in the universe is equally left and right-handed. It's one of the great mysteries of life and of this kind of science. No one really knows how and why this is. It gives us a possibility in the future for how we can determine whether or not something is living, because if you go up to Mars and you find something that has that kind of right-handedness to it or left-handedness to it, that might be a good way of determining whether or not it is alive. But to get to your first question, this is to me one of the really central, fascinating aspects of this whole search for life beyond Earth. What it would mean to society. And you know, some liken it to that moment of Copernicus, where he says, you know, the the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the other way around, it's not something where people are going to, you know, fall over and say, you know, the world is going to end as a result, but it's something that over a period of time may well change our understanding of our place in the universe and could well change religions. The Catholic Church is being very proactive on this. It had an astrobiology conference a year and a half or so ago, and they've made the statement that you know, they're looking forward to meeting their extraterrestrial brothers. that this is not a problem for them. In fact, I'm not sure that that's true. And on my website, www.habitablezones.com, you could find a link to a Stephen Colbert bit on precisely this subject. He used my story as a takeoff point to discuss what finding intelligent life or some kind of advanced life on another planet would do.
We'll have to do that after the show. We're out of time, Mark. We have to go. But thank you so much. It was just fascinating.
Well, I thank you very much, and it's information I love to share with people, so thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Mark Kaufman, the book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Excuse me. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We are all Martians. I like that thought. We'll be with you tomorrow.